This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It's been said that reading is the core of the Common Core. For the most part, education cannot begin without a student first learning how to read.
We refer to it as senior among equals. You know, everything we teach in schools is important, but reading is the most important, not only because reading is so vital in and of itself, but because reading is so central to the mastery of any other discipline, be it math, science, history, etc.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the co-author of the new book, Reading Reconsidered, which looks at the power of reading and how it's being taught on all levels, or at least maybe how it should be. We'll also spend an academic minute finding out what kind of person is more likely to be a part of the grammar police. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In 2010, Doug Lamov wrote an article called Building a Better Teacher, which eventually led to his book Teach Like a Champion. The book compared two schools of thought, one that teaching skills were the most important driver of classroom learning, the other that content knowledge was the true driver. Some readers saw a conflict between these two perspectives. Lamov, along with Erica Woolway and Colleen Driggs, has always thought that the answer was more complex, that yes, technique was irreplaceable and helped teachers maximize the application of their subject knowledge, but there is also no substitute for content knowledge. Their new book is called Reading Reconsidered, A Practical Guide to Rigorous Literacy Instruction, and it's the author's first shot at taking on that challenge of defining subject-specific methods. I spoke to Doug Lamov, and we talked about the importance of reading.
We refer to it as senior among equals. You know, everything we teach in schools is important, but reading is the most important, not only because reading is so vital in and of itself, but because reading is so central to the mastery of any other discipline, be it math, science, history, etc. So there is probably no hyperbole. Hyperbolous enough.
You talk about how Common Core has shifted the teaching of literacy to four major shifts. What are those four?
Yeah, and I would say it's not just the Common Core. It's also the new SAT that's pushing us in this direction. I think the first one is reading more complex texts. You know, there's a lot of evidence that when students get to college, they are not prepared for the text difficulty that they face there. So more difficult texts, reading more nonfiction, close reading, which is something that teachers have been asked to do without getting a really good definition of it, and finally writing directly from the text and using evidence more explicitly.
Well, I'm going to have to back up, and because I did have this one question jotted down. Could you give me a definition of what close reading is?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think maybe to just go big picture for a second, I think this is one of the reasons why we wanted to write this book, which is teachers have been asked to make substantive and challenging changes in the midst of being measured doing them, often without a ton of clarity about what that means. You know, we tried to walk the line between it's possible to oversteer in response to tests and assessments and things like that. And so we tried to identify, you know, what are the high-value things that all teachers can do and be a little bit better at that will result in great teaching but will also result in success on the test. And so one of those things is clearly close reading, and clearly close reading has not been well defined for teachers. So we define it as, well, first of all, we think close reading is something that you do with challenging text, right? If you are trying to close read a text that doesn't push students, the exercise is going to be vacuous, and the reasons for close reading won't be clear to students, and they will become bored with it. So it's an exercise that you do with challenging text, with text that's above your comfort zone. It's a methodical breaking down of how meaning is created within that piece of text, both by establishing meaning, what exactly is being said here, and then by analyzing it. And analyzing it on a variety of levels, but especially on the granular level. Why this word? How would it be different if this word was a different word? Why does this phrase keep occurring over and over again? A lot of times students have what we call gist conversations in the classroom. You understand the main idea of a passage, and then you discuss the main idea of the passage. Is what Shakespeare says about the nature of love true in your experience or not? But having a discussion about the gist of a passage is very different from understanding the entire passage and all of its nuances and all of its allusions. You know, we would never want to go to a doctor who understood the gist of the medical article without understanding all the details, for example. And so, that's one of the challenges of reading at the highest levels is getting the whole thing, not just the main idea.
Well, that goes back to that first one you mentioned, which was choosing more difficult texts to read.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really critical. You know, Common Core has been pretty explicit. They've asked us to read harder texts. I actually think no matter how you feel about the Common Core, there's a lot of justification for this. But they've said read two levels higher according to Lexiles. The problem from our perspective is that Lexiles are, you know, people say about accountants that they would rather be precisely wrong than generally right. And I think there's something about Lexiles. They can be precisely wrong rather than generally right. And they don't always get at the reasons why texts are difficult. So if you score The Outsiders and Lord of the Flies, according to their Lexiles, they're almost indistinguishable. But any English teacher who's listening to this right now knows, without my having to say it, that Lord of the Flies is 10 times more difficult to teach and to read than The Outsiders. And so we tried to take a look at some of the reasons why certain texts are more challenging than others, and we came up with a tongue-in-cheek name for a very serious topic, which is we call them the five plagues of the developing reader, five things that make texts especially challenging, that we think it's really, you know, it's important for teachers to expose students to these things. They may love being in your class if you don't challenge them in these ways, but several years down the line, if no one's taken the time to expose them to these kind of texts, they're really going to struggle. So one example of that would be archaic text. People wrote and spoke differently in the past. So if you expect to walk onto a college campus and read Charles Darwin or the Declaration of Independence or Canterbury Tales and you've never read a book that's more than 100 years old, you're dead. you just don't have a fighting chance. And so even starting in fifth or sixth grade, it would be really, you know, it's a great idea to start exposing students gradually and incrementally to older texts. For example, Magician's Nephew. You know, it's only 60 years old, C.S. Lewis's great story, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe series. But it begins to expose students to the sorts of inverted syntax and different word choices that come up in older texts.
What about nonfiction? That seems to be, I've heard that from a lot of people, that that's really important.
Yeah, it's important and challenging. So, you know, there's research out there that suggests that historically, kids have read 80 to 90% of what they've read in their K-12 years has been fiction or narrative nonfiction, memoirs, et cetera. Well, then they set foot on college campus, and 80 to 90% of what they read is nonfiction. And it's not just nonfiction, it's dense nonfiction. It's summaries of medical journal articles. It's primary historical documents. It's critical essays about the literature that they read. And so if they hope to be successful, they need a lot of experience reading those things. Nonfiction is more challenging. It's not always engaging. It's not as likely to be written in a narrative voice that's designed to engage you and draw you in. Often the narrative voice is more of the stay with me if you can variety. And it doesn't follow the same conventions. You know, even kids who aren't big readers have been constantly exposed to the conventions of narrative, problem and solution, character development, anytime you watch TV or you watch a movie. And so kids have much less experience with nonfiction, so it's really important that they read more nonfiction. But the challenge of nonfiction is that so often they read nonfiction out of context. When I was an English teacher, I did this. We did a unit on nonfiction, and we read it from a formalist standpoint. We would look at the structure of the nonfiction and the subheadings and the captions and things like that. This is sort of how you were taught to do your nonfiction. And the topics of the articles would be, well, they'd be kind of irrelevant to me. So one day we'd read an article on the American Revolution, and the next day we'd read one on the naked mole rat. And so kids are constantly put in a situation where they have no context for the text that they're reading. They have no real engagement in them, and so they are absorbing less of what they're reading. So one of the things that we've noticed that really great teachers tend to do is they embed nonfiction in the primary fiction that they're reading. So if you're reading a novel, you might choose 8 or 10 small, interesting details in the novel to read an article about, to both illuminate more of the novel and bring it to life, and also to give kids opportunities to read nonfiction that's connected to something they care about and to help them understand why people would want to read nonfiction in the first place. So a colleague, my colleague in writing the book, Colleen Driggs, who's a former reading teacher, I was observing her class when she was reading Lily's Crossing, which she was reading with fifth graders. It's a novel about a girl during World War II in New York living at home. And there are all these allusions to things like victory gardens and blackout shades and rationing of butter and things like that. And so Colleen would bring in articles on, well, what is a victory garden? What did it look like? How did they, you know, how is it designed? What was rationing? What sorts of things were rationed? How did they decide? So they would read lots and lots of nonfiction in little pieces related to the book. And this both brought the book to life historically, but because the kids cared so much about this character, Lily, who was going through rationing, all of a sudden this article on a rather dry subject became kind of engaging to them. And so they read their nonfiction with much more engagement and got much more practice reading dense expository nonfiction.
Still to come, our conversation with Doug Lamov continues with a look at the importance of reading aloud. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Doug Lamov, co-author of the book Reading Reconsidered, A Practical Guide to Rigorous Literacy Instruction. We're talking about teaching reading in the classroom, and I asked him about reading aloud. It seems he has strong opinions on that topic.
Just going to take a minute to get up on my soapbox here.
Okay.
We believe deeply in reading aloud. Not only reading aloud, there also should be lots of silent reading. But reading aloud is kind of scorned in many classrooms. One teacher at one of our workshops said, when I read aloud in my classroom, I live in fear that an administrator is going to walk into my classroom and ask me why I'm not teaching. But reading aloud does several things for students that we think are really, really important. And this occurs whether it's the teacher reading aloud or in a carefully designed way students are reading aloud. First of all, when you read aloud to students, you can read aloud to them from a more complex text than they can read and decipher on their own. And so you expose them to vocabulary, which is critical to learning and to all learning gaps. You also expose them to more complex syntax. And we've all worked with the students who, they understand the words perfectly, but they can't unwind a very complex sentence with multiple clauses and multiple subordinating clauses even. So they understand the main clause, but they don't understand how the clause that comes after it actually undercuts the premise of the main clause. And so they understand part of a sentence, but not the whole sentence. Well, one of the ways to help them with that is by constantly reading aloud to them so that they hear what complex language sounds like when the best reader in the room, the teacher or parent, breathes life into it. So reading aloud is incredibly important in that way. But, it's also important because, I don't want to be too dramatic about this, but reading is dying. If you look at the research on how much time, especially kids, but also people, spend reading and reading for pleasure, the numbers are going down steeply. Reading competes with the device that's in your pocket right now that's been designed by the greatest technological minds of our generation to constantly distract you from deep and reflective exercises like reading with bright flashing lights. And so the result is that kids read a lot less now than they ever have before. And so one of the things we think that has to happen is we have to build cultures around reading. So to us, one of the most powerful things we've seen in classrooms is classrooms where kids see their classmates reading aloud with pleasure, with expression, breathing life into a book, laughing at the book, having deep emotions about the book, and seeing that this is a powerful experience. This is why we have read and read aloud for generations immemorial. So the social and cultural aspects of reading aloud to kids, we think it's just deeply, deeply important and only becomes more important as books fight their battle against technology for the attention of kids. And this is interesting because there are a lot of people who would tell you you should never have kids read aloud in the classroom. They have a denigrating name for it, popcorn reading. And what they say is, you should never do that because it's a waste of time, and if one kid is reading, what are the other kids reading? But actually, there are very simple ways to engineer student oral reading in the classroom so that it's an incredibly productive activity that leads to deep understanding and comprehension and builds a culture around reading that we think is sorely needed and sorely missing.
I'm wondering, in actual experience, what does the class get more out of, the teacher reading to them or various classmates reading to them?
Well, I think that's a great question, and then also reading silently, and we would say a great classroom probably has a balanced portfolio of those three things. The majority of the reading that kids will do for the duration of their studies and their lives will be silent reading to themselves, so they need lots of practice doing that. But there's incredible power in the adult breathing life into a complex text, the best reader in the room reading it lovingly and reflectively. And there's also incredible power in seeing your classmates read, and in a positive culture, read expressively and competing to, you know, to see if they can breathe as much life into the book as their teacher. And so we think that all three of those are needed in balance. Lots of times in education, you know, we like to say, well, this is the one best way, and we're not believers in a one best way. It's usually about a balanced portfolio of ways.
Is teaching vocabulary still a thing that's done with, you know, okay, here's a word, here's the definition, or is it done in the context of reading now, mostly?
You have put your finger on the big debate in vocabulary.
Okay.
Which is, you know, should you teach it explicitly? Here is a list of words. Here's the definition of them. Use it in a sentence. Or do you just let kids learn words by reading them? And I think there are really strong arguments for both sides of this debate. One of the things that research tells us about vocabulary is that deep word meaning correlates to student achievement as well or better than breadth of word meaning. In other words, how well you know the words you do, their nuances, their subtleties, the way that they change in different settings, is at least as important as how many words you know, especially from a reading perspective. And so we need to know words deeply. And this is very interesting, you know, if you think about the synonym model of teaching vocabulary, which is I learned that to mimic means imitate. So that's what I remember. You know, I have a one-word synonym for every vocabulary word. Well, if those two words overlap 80 or 90% in their meaning, that seems really useful. But when you come across mimic in a passage that you're reading, it's actually the 10% of mimic that's different from imitate that's important. In other words, the fact that mimic is slightly pejorative and implies that someone is making fun of someone else. Well, that's the part of the word that creates the nuance of the passage, and where you read the subtext of the passage or the meaning of the passage is actually created from the difference there. And so it's important to teach words with depth, which implies probably some explicit vocabulary instruction. You know, that probably is a necessary part of any good classroom. That's how you teach kids how words move and change depending on the setting. But if you do the numbers on it, and you think, well, how many vocabulary words could I teach like that per day and per week? You know, even if you taught 5 per day and 25 per week, which any teachers who are listening to this are probably, you know, beginning to catch their breath because that's a lot of vocabulary to have kids really learn and master. You could never close the vocabulary gap between kids of privilege and kids who are cut off from opportunity in particular. You know, there's just too many words that kids need to learn. And so we also have to have strategies for what we call implicit vocabulary, which is as we're reading together and as you're reading, how do I help draw your attention to the words that you read more? How do I help you learn more about them and be more attentive to them so that you also learn more when you're reading? Because that's the way that we end up learning most of the words that we learn in our lives. So we advocate for a two-part strategy. Yes, you should do some explicit vocabulary instruction. You should focus on depth of word meaning there. And you should also be responsive, you know, use a variety of tricks and tools and approaches that we describe in the book for to get the most out of vocabulary as it comes up during your reading. And maybe one small hint for people who are interested in this, I think a lot of teachers spend their time on vocabulary instruction having kids guess at word meanings. What do you think destitute means in this sentence? And that, it seems like that's problem solving, but it's actually not always that productive a form of problem solving. A lot of research suggests that what's more valuable would be to start by giving kids a definition. Destitute means to be utterly without important resources. And then engage the kids in when they would be guessing at the word meaning, engage kids in a form of wordplay. So how might a tyrant be destitute? How might a person who is a king be destitute? Could you be destitute in ways other than without money? What are the resources that most make you destitute? Can you be happy if you're destitute? Asking kids to play with the word, use it in different forms. You know, what's the noun form of this word, et cetera. Research suggests that you have to use a word 15 times to really own it. And you want to use it in different settings. And so wordplay is a form of problem solving that's probably more productive, we think, than guessing at word meanings. And so just by giving the definition earlier and doing more play with the word afterwards, it's probably more productive than having kids trying to guess at definitions that they, frankly, just don't know.
I'll end this up here talking about what you call the ultimate goal of reading instruction, which is intellectual autonomy, which those two words, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Thank you for asking about that, by the way. It's the chapter that people ask about the least, even though, you know, it's so important. What we talk about there is the fact that kids have to learn to not answer our questions about the text, but to generate their own interpretations and their own lines of thinking. But we still think that you can gradually teach kids to do that by giving them frameworks, ways of thinking about texts. And, you know, when someone comes up with a really unique interpretation of a text, well, sometimes it's impossible to predict where it comes from, but they're actually in some ways using and reusing a core set of ideas. So, for example, does this text follow the convention, or does it diverge from the convention of this sort of genre, and if so, how and why? Learning to look for those things kind of leads, gives you clues to coming up with your own interpretation. Is the version of history or some event that is told by this book, is it accurate? Or are there ways in which it distorts history? And if so, how and why? So you read a novel that takes place in the Civil War. And what part of the, you know, truth about the Civil War is being represented by the novel and distorted by the novel? And if over time you use frameworks like that to think about texts over time, you know, you can ask that question about any text, and it can often lead to the sorts of insights that we think are that come out of nowhere. It's a way of teaching kids how to approach a text and think about it in a unique way. So we talk about a variety of frameworks and a variety of ways to gradually let kids take more and more ownership over, begin to think about asking their own questions about texts, so that in the end, it's them interpreting as opposed to answering our own questions.
The name of Doug Lamov's new book is Reading Reconsidered, A Practical Guide to Rigorous Literacy Instruction. His co-authors are Erica Woolway and Colleen Driggs. It's published by Wiley. So you've just written a brilliant essay on something. It doesn't matter. And the first reaction you get is about your spelling and punctuation. What kind of, let's say, person does that? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Why are some people the grammar police and others not? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Robin Queen, professor of linguistics at the University of Michigan, delves into whether personality type may determine if you care about whether someone typed the right there or there.
Have you ever wondered why some people are especially bothered by typos and grammatical errors that other people seem not to even notice? My co-author, Julie Boland, and I were too. Not only were we curious about why people respond differently to errors, we were also curious whether people respond differently to different types of errors. So we created a set of pretend email messages in which we embedded two kinds of errors. First, we included keyboarding errors, such as occur when a writer transposes two different characters. Second, we used homophonous terms that people often mistake, such as T-O for T-O-O. We asked listeners to read the email messages and then to rate the imagined writer. People were bothered by both types of errors, but their demographic differences didn't predict who was more likely to be bothered. Neither did their reading habits or how important they thought good grammar is. Curious. We also asked them to take a psychometric personality assessment known as the Big Five. This assessment includes extroversion, agreeableness, openness to experience, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. All of these but neuroticism turned out to capture some of the variability in how people responded to the errors. People who were more conscientious or less open were more bothered by the keyboarding errors. People who were less agreeable were more bothered by the grammatical errors. And people who were more introverted were bothered by both types of errors. While many people have interpreted our study as suggesting that people who care about correct grammar are therefore crabby jerks, we actually interpret it the opposite. People who notice grammatical errors aren't necessarily being jerks. Rather, there are some personality traits that make us more or less sensitive to this kind of variation, and that's one of the wonderful components of human variation.
That was Robin Queen of the University of Michigan. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of the Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.